I was born, of course, in the north of England. I was born in West Hartlepool during the First World War. In fact, at the time when a German battleship, the Emden, was bombarding the town. And so that as soon as I was born, my mother was so alarmed that she brought me to London, where after a matter of 10 days, I was brought up until I left for business and candidated an offer for the ministry. So technically I am a northerner, but in fact I'm really a Londoner. Mm-hmm. And Brixton was my home. I've retired here just over 8 years ago, after having had 41 years in the Methodist ministry, and I'm enjoying it here immensely.
You came here before you retired?
No.
You were working in the ministry in the Methodist church?
No. Here? No, I finished in North London, and on our days off, we, not knowing much of this part of the country, we explored it a bit, and we came to the conclusion that we'd like to be as near to our son and his family, but not in London itself. And we thought it would be nice to be somewhere near Cambridge. We didn't want to be in Costa Geriatrica. We wanted to be where there's some young life. And we found this place here at Hop Row and alighted upon it, and all the necessary arrangements were made. And we've settled down here very, very happily.
What does your wife think about this area?
She likes it very much. She likes the spaciousness. She likes the open countryside. It's an interesting countryside. It's a working countryside. And she loves the skies. And, of course, the general flatness of it, which for a lady of her age, and indeed mine, it's a little kinder on us when we find it more difficult to get up hills. Mm-hmm. Although from time to time we go up to the north of England, where we enjoy the hills, the Yorkshire moors. We've been up there this year and enjoy that very much. But we're always pleased to come back here. And we're always particularly pleased to be in a village community, which is nice and compact. It's very friendly. We find a community in which there's a variety of activity. We could be out 14 nights a week if we wished. There's plenty to do. And moreover, from the point of view of my ministry, although I'm retired and Joan is retired, we have found plenty of opportunity to be of service, both in the church and outside.
Mm. You lived in the towns. Had you lived in a rural community before that?
Only at the very beginning of my ministry, when I was in the Sevenoaks circuit, we lived in the village of Otford, which was a country village, but it was on the outskirts of London, and while there was an indigenous country community, it was also growing from people who were commuting from the City of London and so on. So we had a very mixed community. It wasn't in the sense in which Haddenham is, or many of the rural villages around here in the Fens. It wasn't a strictly rural community. It was a very mixed community. It was a commuter community. I had a very happy time there. And I had a circuit responsibility in which I had to look after 9 out of 11 churches. So I had plenty to do.
Certainly. Did you come from good Methodist stock?
No, I'm an Anglican. Anglican background. In my late teens, through a friend, I was introduced, albeit reluctantly, to our local Methodist church. And while I was there, I had a very, very real experience of the love of God in Jesus Christ. And I made my commitment. And from that, I felt a call to preach. From that, a call into the ministry. And so, from an Anglican background, moved into the Methodist Church, which of course wasn't all that strange, because the roots of Methodism are soundly in the Church of England, historically speaking. But yet it had a freedom and a flexibility, and there was a quality of fellowship, and there was a directness in the preaching of the gospel. And it offered a way of life and a vocation which I found to be increasingly satisfied, so that if I had my life over again, I would do precisely the same thing.
Did you go straight into the ministry from school or university?
No. I went out to work, and I went out to work at the age of 16. I was preparing to be a draftsman, and I was doing all sorts of studies at the Borough Polytechnic and the Battersea Polytechnic, and I suddenly got fed up with it all. I just got tired of study. So, unknown to my parents, I got hold of the Daily Telegraph, which always had a great list of situations vacant. And I noticed there an advertisement for a mechanically minded young man to be in a growing American firm in London, which happened to be Ronson Products. And so I applied for the job and got it, where I remained for some years. And it was while I was there that I came into the Methodist Church, and it was there that my call to the ministry began. And so then I really had to study again in earnest and make up a lot of lost time. Mm-hmm. But I succeeded, and I was accepted in 1939. In fact, I went to college in the week that war broke out. War broke out on the Sunday, and I went up to college on the Thursday, to Handsworth in Birmingham, where I remained for a year. And at the end of that year, because of the war situation, the college closed. And in that following September of 40, when, of course, the Blitz began and so on over London, I resumed my college at Richmond in southwest London. And there I remained for a further year, when they closed that college at the end of it because, again, of the war situation. And we were going to go up to Headingley near Leeds. But I'd done rather well in my exams. I'd got certain qualifications even at the end of the 2 years. So I sought permission to leave college at the end of 2 years rather than three or four. And so I did, and began my ministry in 1941 on the staff of the South East London Mission, where I remained for 5 years, and then, which was during my period of probation, we had probation studies after leaving college. And at the end of that period, I was ordained and carried on.
Did you have goals to achieve? Did you set yourself goals at the beginning of your ministry? Can you remember?
Not particular goals. I think I wanted to be an all-rounder as far as possible. I always felt the importance of the pastoral ministry. I always had an interest in people. I wanted to be of maximum help and maximum availability as far as they were concerned. I had a deep conviction about the importance of preaching, and I still have, and I took that very seriously. And of course, as a young man, I was particularly interested in youth work. And for the first 20 years of my ministry, I was heavily engaged in work among young people. My first circuit when I was on the Old Kent Road, in the South East London Mission. I opened up a youth centre there, which was a 7-night-a-week job. That's where I lost my hair. And we had all sorts of, literally, hair-raising experiences, for it was all during the war. But it was a very, very good apprenticeship, where one had to do literally everything. I preached on Sunday, I did masses of pastoral work, I spent night after night in rest centres, going around the hospitals. Had to bail out water from the premises that we were using temporarily, because my main church had been bombed. In fact, every church in the circuit had been bombed. And had to do bill posting and stoking, and did the whole lot.
It was a good apprenticeship, too.
Very good apprenticeship, yes, yes.
How did you meet your wife?
When I went to the Methodist Church. I went with this friend, as I've said before, member of the congregation. She was in the choir. And I heard a very beautiful voice. And I sought to locate it. And at last I did. And my eye focused on her, and strangely enough, and to my surprise, her eye focused on me. And it was literally love at first sight. There were all sorts of difficulties in the way that I wouldn't want to go into, but ultimately we won through, and while there was a temporary breakdown, for certain reasons, as soon as I resumed, or as soon as I went to college, not resumed, as soon as I went to college, the relationship started up again. And of course at that time, which is something that isn't common knowledge and doesn't apply to Methodist ministers today, we were not permitted to marry until we were ordained, which meant that I had to wait 7 years. In fact, more than 7 years, because I'd known Joan before I went to college. And so we had to look forward to 7 years of a relationship which was very precious, but which was very difficult, because we wanted to be married and we wanted to enjoy all that marriage means. We were fortunate in that we did get a slight reduction, because my wife had to go into the services, she was an officer, and there was a chance that she might have to go to South Africa. And I thought, well, that's a poor do, having been waiting all this time, now she'd like to go off to South Africa and I shan't see her for another year or two. So I made an urgent application to our church authorities, and fortunately they saw the position, and as soon as the act that was to send my wife abroad became effective, I got the permission to get married, which meant that as a married officer she did not have to go abroad. And so we managed to get a few months relief, as it were. And we were married in April 1945.
Long time ago.
45 years this year.
And your children?
Just one son. He now lives in London. He's on the staff of the BBC. He is an editor in the newsroom. And the interesting thing about him is, of course, that as a result, as part of his journalistic career, first of all, of course, on the street, and then at Radio Brighton, and then he came to the BBC in London. After a while, he got fed up with being the BBC and went off to Hong Kong. And he spent 11 years in Hong Kong and remaining 18 months in Peking. During that time, he met and married a Chinese lady, Sylvia. And they are now the proud parents of two grandsons, Oliver and William. And we're very, very thrilled. Robert continues, of course, back at the BBC, having done his term in Hong Kong.
Did you want him to follow you into the ministry, or did you
want him to... It would have been, I should have been, you know, been very pleased, obviously. It would have been nice if that had been possible. But I put no pressure upon him at all. He's a very good lad. He's very soundly based. He's got a very strong ethical outlook, which he applies, incidentally, in his professional life. No, he had no sense of vocation. But the interesting thing is there are many sons and daughters of the manse in the BBC, for some reason or other, and he's just one of them.
Hmm. Do you think he got his journalistic leanings from his mother, then?
Possibly, because she does write, as you are aware. And indeed I do, you see. We both are. I mean, I speak mostly, but I also write, but she writes books. And it is certainly possible. He wanted, of course, to go in for economics. That was his bent. But when he was doing his A-levels, he took a terrific interest in English literature and in writing. And it was that which, I think, led him into the journalistic field. And he is a natural journalist. He can sniff a story out from anywhere.
All the circuits you were involved with, which was the most memorable one you had?
They've all been very interesting from different points of view, I think. My last circuit was particularly happy because I had a very heavy responsibility, both in the circuit and in terms of the district, which brought all kinds of challenges and problems. It was very challenging. And I met some very dear and wonderful friends who were absolutely marvellous when it came to our retirement. I suppose I would say that my very first circuit is a circuit that made an indelible impression upon me, because one, it was wartime. Two, there wasn't a single church in the circuit standing. They'd all been bombed and we were all making do in temporary situations. And the third thing is that it was an entirely different kind of ministry from the normal pattern of things, because you were literally living from day to day and from night to night. You never knew what was going to happen next. And you had to be on the ball from dawn until dusk. And it was fascinating, it was harrowing, it was interesting. So that, in one sense, and one had to do at the same time, because one was on probation, one had to do one's academic work as well, write essays and all the rest of it. Every circuit has had its special point. When I was in Middlesbrough, I was the chaplain at the mental hospital for 5 years. And I found that particularly interesting because I'd specialised in psychology in college. And there, of course, I was doing casework and enjoyed that work very much, and it helped me to lay the foundation for what became virtually 30 years of counselling ministry.
Did you find that part of your ministry harrowing at all?
From time to time, but I think I suppose from time to time one felt the sadness of the situation. People from Alzheimer's disease and senile dementia and so on, dealing with suicide attempts, of which there were quite a few. On the other hand, one was able to get alongside people, and one was able to register that one cared. And also there was a very real sense of comradeship between the chaplain and the staff, which doesn't happen so much in an ordinary general hospital. There were many spiritual problems underlying the mental breakdowns. There were all kinds of tensions, problems, and this was very interesting. I think I found it very interesting, very challenging, moving, harrowing sometimes, but always, always rewarding.
Mm. Mm. One thinks, were you trying to convey a message to them or an understanding? And if so, what was it sometimes, it must have been very hard to get that message across.
Well, I think that what one sought to do in the mental hospital was to convey the sense that whatever sense of loneliness, isolation, bewilderment that these people were going through, one conveyed the sense that there was somebody with them,
mm-hmm.
that somebody cared. One didn't put across any particular dominational emphasis, certainly not. One didn't seek to thrust religion, for want of a better word, down their throats. They knew who I was. They knew I was a minister. They knew I represented the Christian faith, and I went in as their friend, as one who tried to understand a sense of being with them in their distresses or whatever it may be. We had a service every Sunday evening at 5 o'clock, which I used to take for the so-called Free Church people in the hospital, and we had 20, 30, 40, 50 of these, and there one would speak for a matter of about 6 or 7 minutes and seek in a very positive way, perhaps through a story, but never without placing the emphasis upon the presence and the love and the grace and the healing power of God. And that whoever they were, whatever the reason that had brought them into hospital, they were never, ever outside the love of God.
Mm. I understand that around this area, since you've been in this area, are you the chaplain or the padre at the Ely RAF hospital?
Yes.
What does that involve?
Well, I'm what is called a CSFC padre, that is the Church of Scotland Free Church padre, which means that I have pastoral responsibility for all the Free Church personnel of the hospital, the RAF personnel of the hospital. And if they're not Free Church or Church of Scotland, but if they're Muslims or they're Hindus or they're nothing at all, that technically comes under my particular concern. But of course at the hospital, we have, in addition to the military personnel, military patients, we have NHS patients. And 9/10 of my work is on the wards. I'm available, of course, from the CO down to the lowliest airman as and when they may need me. And there are certain occasions where, as an officiating chaplain, for that is my official title, along with my Anglican and my Roman Catholic colleagues, we officiate, we function, we do what we have to do. But as a Free Church padre, I'm responsible for the Free Church personnel of the hospital and all Free Church patients coming in from other RAF stations, from Lossiemouth to or from anywhere else, to care for them and to be available to them and so on. But of course also to the National Health patients. Mm-hmm. But that isn't recognised, isn't technically part of my job, but of course.
You see, at the start of this interview you said you retired.
Yeah.
Technically you haven't, have you?
A minister never retires. I'm retired from a stipendiary point of view. I simply receive my pensions, my church and my senior citizen's pension, my state pension. But I'm under obligation in terms of my ordination vows to be a minister and to observe the disciplines of a ministry. And as opportunity affords, and of course as one's strength allows, to do whatever opportunities open up, to avail oneself of whatever opportunities open up. I preach regularly, not almost every Sunday, at least once every fortnight or 3 weeks around various places. and I do a tutorial. I look after some local preachers in training. I have the chaplaincy service, do a little bit of writing occasionally. But I also have plenty of free time, and one of the things that I am free from doing is administration. I can do the thing I'm ordained to do without all the paperwork. I've been asked to share with you some of the writings from the scripture and elsewhere, which mean a lot to me, and which I hope will strike a chord with you. Owing to copyright, the choice is somewhat restricted, but nonetheless, enough, I would like to think, to be enjoyable. I want to begin with part of John of Gaunt's speech in Richard II, Act II, in which Shakespeare somewhat idealises this England of ours. Yet, as we become increasingly part of the European community, these words might inspire and encourage us to see that we may still have a unique contribution to make. This royal throne of kings, this sceptred isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this other Eden, demi-paradise, this fortress built by nature for herself, against infection and the hand of war. This happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea, which serves it in the office of a wall, or as a moat defensive to a house, against the envy of less happier lands. This blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England, this nurse, this teeming womb of royal kings, feared by their breed and famous by their birth, renowned for their deeds as far from home, for Christian service and true chivalry, as is the sepulchre in stubborn jury of the world's ransom, Blessed Mary's son.
We are approaching the end of side one. When the music finishes, please turn over the tape and side two will begin almost immediately.